You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
I want to explain to you how important the vote is. We know that there is still a gap.
Time is running out for Benjamin Netanyahu. With voting in Israel well underway, we'll consider the possible outcomes for today's election and ask what a defeat for Bibi could mean for the country and the wider region. Then, American reporting powerhouse Politico is attempting to replicate its success over there, here in Europe. But can they bring the same DC magic to Brussels? We'll find out. All that, plus press censorship in Mexico and China, and plenty of other stories besides, coming up right now on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. This is Midori House on Monocle 24, a minute past the top of the hour. To discuss the big stories of the day, I'm joined here in Studio One by the journalist and broadcaster Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and by George Brock, professor of journalism at City University London and author of the book Out of Print. Welcome to you both. Let's start today's show with the political situation in Israel that few perhaps would have predicted just weeks, let alone months ago. The fate of the country's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is uncertain today as Israelis head to the polls, which close tonight at 10 p.m. local time. Results are expected to be released soon after. The unthinkable, however, or the previously unthinkable, that Netanyahu will lose has become an ever more real outcome. So what would happen then? Isabel, perhaps we'll start with you. Is it wrong to sort of characterise this as a story about, you know, the political journey of Netanyahu and what his political fate might be should he lose? Or should we focus on the bigger picture?
But it's not wrong, because he has, you know, embodied a particularly, you know, virulent strain of Israeli policy. And of course, you know, the fate of Netanyahu is also the fate of the wider Middle East. So it's not wrong in that sense. What I think is confusing, though, is to assume that if he loses the election, or if he gets fewer votes than other parties, that he's lost the election. Because the real joy of Israeli politics is that it's about coalition forming. So you can end up... as a weaker party that hasn't got a majority, but he could still have the convening power and the capacity to put together a coalition that would bring him back to government. And we won't really know that for quite a long time. We won't know that. It could be weeks before we know that.
It's interesting, George, to sort of take a bit of a listen to some of the rhetoric. And we heard in the introduction some quotes from Netanyahu. What's being reported that he said more recently is even more arresting. He's apparently expressed alarm in the last few hours at the number of Israeli Arabs that might turn out and the sort of damage that could inflict politically on him. He said things like right-wing rule is in danger, which even by his own sort of rabble-rousing standards is pretty arresting. Do you think has he sort of misjudged maybe the political appetite, the political... atmosphere within Israel, do you think?
He's a flailing man. He's been thrashing around. That kind of calm, purposeful image which he adopted for many years, he's just lost completely in the last few days. So he has, yes, been caught on the hop, but Isabel is quite right to point out that he could be behind in seats, he could be behind in the share of the vote, and he could still be the Israeli prime minister. Nobody's ever won an overall majority in modern Israel, ever. And so everything is in the coalition building. But if he were to become prime minister after complicated and painful and tortuous negotiations, I think it would be fair to say that he would have lost a lot of his legitimacy and authority. He would be a man on the defensive, and heaven knows what Bibi on the defensive would be like. It might be quite dangerous.
Could be even more flailing. What about then? I mean, it's perhaps too soon to sort of judge someone's political career whilst the votes are still coming in. But in terms of Netanyahu as, I don't know, Isabel, as statesman, I mean, do you think, has he been any good or not?
Well, Netanyahu is a man who has, you know, pretty much wrecked the Middle East peace process for the sake of his own political career. Is that statesmanship? I'm not sure. I think his image also took a bit of a knock with that extraordinary visit he made to Washington, uninvited by the president, but you know, making his number with certain parts of Congress, particularly, you know, the right. I think had a slight air of desperation. If really, you know, that is where he's ended up after being in power in Israel and being such a big figure in Israel, not on speaking terms with the White House. That's not really great statesmanship. And curiously, you know, of course, that's what we look at Israeli elections for. But if you look at the issues that the voters are concerned about, they're the usual things that voters are concerned about. The cost of living, jobs for the young people, all those things. You know, Israel's economy not doing too well. And so whilst you have this disjunction between what international comment is looking for in an Israeli leader, and actually the fact that voters vote as they do on domestic and personal issues.
It's interesting, George, that Isabel cited that sort of speech to Congress and that whole trip, which was very striking in terms of the, well, I guess the lack of diplomacy in some respects. Would it be good news for the US, do you think, if Netanyahu is out of the picture? We know, you know, he and Obama obviously don't, not necessarily the best of friends at the moment, to put it lightly. Is it a good news story for the US, or does it just, it's one complicated situation in exchange for another?
No, I think it would be good news for the Americans in two different senses. Firstly, if Herzog does end up as the prime minister and does displace Netanyahu, they will have somebody who is closer to their own ideas. However, they will be extremely concerned with is how stable Herzog's position actually is. We're back with the coalition. We're back with the coalition problems. And, you know, let's not forget that one of the flip-flops that Netanyahu has done that I think has not really not helped him in the eyes of voters, even people disposed to approve of him, is that in 2009 he said, we can have a two-state solution. And in this campaign, he said categorically, we are not going to have a two-state solution. So from the American point of view, okay, the idea of a two-state solution had been around for a very long time and nobody's made all that much progress to it. But to have an Israeli prime minister who's saying, I'm ruling this out, it's just not going to happen, that's going backwards from their point of view. So anyone else, they must by now be in a position of, anyone but Bibi, please.
I mean, that's an interesting point. Do you think, Isabel, that, you know, if it was, say, this Herzog, Tzipi, Livni, you know, the Zionist Union, who are the sort of the brokers, is that then necessarily better for the region? Or is it rather, as George says, that anything that's not Netanyahu gives it a bit more of a chance?
Well, I think the two aren't contradictory. I think that if you had a change of leader in Israel, a change of government, then you would have the chance, at least, of a fresh start in Middle East negotiations with Bibi, absolutely not. We're stuck, and we're stuck, really. There'll be a change of president, but I can't see what is going to change in the Middle East if Bibi gets back in. So we are back on a miserable round of increasing tensions and no progress.
What about the issue of Iran, George? Because it's interesting that, you know, Netanyahu again has been very vocal about this. That was sort of one of the key parts of the speech that he delivered in the US a few weeks ago. Do you think, again, was that political expediency? Was it just rhetoric? You know, or do, you know, does Netanyahu genuinely believe that Iran poses an existential threat to Israel? Or was he just sort of playing, you know, a political game again with that?
Tom, I think I better admit I don't know the answer to that question. I think it was 50-50 mixture, quite honestly. I think both things indicate, you know, both his own belief and what he took to be his politically expedient things probably united. But, I mean, again, I would have thought that the Americans would regard that as a gain in relation to Iran. If they think they can cut a deal with Iran, and sometimes they do believe they can, not to have Netanyahu there doing everything he can to wreck it can not only be good from the American point of view, but actually I think it's probably good from the world's point of view.
Isabel, do you think it's fair to say then that, you know, Netanyahu, if we look back at his recent contribution, that it's been broadly damaging just to the prospects in the region of any sort of immediate progress, to Israel's image as well, which is obviously something that's always, you know, something of a battle. Has he just been a damaging figure? That's not a controversial view.
Extraordinarily damaging. I think that the international public response to the incursions in Gaza, to the, you know, the treatment of the Palestinians, the relentlessness of the application, disproportionate application of force on the part of Israel, you know, it is completely asymmetric. And I think it has been extremely bad for Israel's image, and it's been extremely bad for prospects of Israel being a peaceful and prosperous country and the region, you know, getting over. He's part of what has driven the Middle East politics to extremes. And you can't you can't make progress at that point. Then you're simply locked into antagonisms. And any progress that there was on Iran, and there has been progress on Iran, immediately Netanyahu comes in and dismisses it and opposes it. And as George says, it's pretty wearing for an American president who's been trying to, you know, cut deals in the Middle East, or at least make some progress, to have its principal ally no longer really on the same page. And that's quite serious. I don't see any way forward as long as that's the case.
Just one last footnote on Netanyahu. We're liable to give the impression that we think he's going to lose the election in Israel because of all these international questions. Actually, it's very strongly suggested by the polls that, in fact, it's the rise in the price of food and the price of houses that actually has made him trail in the polls.
I mean, just to follow up on that point then, I guess some people would look for reassurance of sorts that perhaps the fact that there's a disconnect between Netanyahu, his rhetoric to his home audience, you know, some of his defenders still saying, actually, he's been quite good. He's fought our corner, you know, the rise of nationalism. And you might say, oh, well, if he does lose the election, it will be because that's actually not the most important thing for, you know, the Israeli electorate. But you're suggesting it's not that, sadly. It is the more mundane day-to-day politics at home, as perhaps you'd find anywhere else in the world.
The impression I have is that people think that Netanyahu, in Israel, people think Netanyahu has gone from being strong to being reckless. And I doubt they really have much doubts about the strength of Herzog. He comes from a very, very distinguished and important Israeli family. There is really very little record of Israeli Labour Party leaders being weak when it comes to when push comes to shove. I really doubt that's the difference between them. It's the economy, stupid.
We'll certainly keep a close eye on that, and obviously we'll be bringing you updates here on Monocle 24 over the next day or so as we learn more. Let's move on now, though, on Midori House to the media world. In just over a month, Politico Europe will launch its website with dozens of reporters based in Brussels and bureau opening in Paris, here in London and Berlin. This new Europe-focused sister of the highly popular American news operation is a joint venture with German media conglomerate Axel Springer, which has dipped its toes into various journalism startups in recent months. But can they replicate that American magic over in Brussels? George, we'll start with you. Can they do that, do you think?
It's going to be a really, really interesting experiment, he says with some care. They are starting on a very ambitious scale, and I have a terrible feeling that they think that it's like the coverage of Washington in Brussels. Now, they've hired people who must know that that is not the case, so I'm not quite sure what they're about. This is quite an odd place for an international website that is doing, or an American website, which is doing really well and has the clout and the resources to expand, to land. I mean, you know, Gawker has gone to India, BuzzFeed is turning up all over the place, Quartz has just opened, planning to open in South Africa, whereas Politico goes to Brussels. The advertising market in the whole world is expanding is expected to expand this year by about 5%, while in Europe it's going to expand at half that rate. And the politics in Brussels are very opaque, extremely complex, lack a great deal of drama, and are, you know, produce very few really dazzling personalities. Not impossible to report, but very, very tough. I've done it.
Yes. That was the sound of Isabel Hilton stifling a laugh. The idea of these sort of, you know, great charismatic characters. I mean, is that a problem that could almost undermine this before it really gets started?
There are so many problems that could undermine this. I barely know where to begin. Like George, I've done this. And I mean, one of the problems with reporting the European Union is by the time you understand it, you are so far in the machine, you've forgotten how to explain it to normal human beings. You know, the idea of single dashing narratives of the kind that you get in American politics in Europe. I mean, where do I begin with the problems? You know, they have correspondents in various member states. So are we reporting the member states vis-a-vis the European Union? Are we reporting the member states? In what language are we publishing? Are we publishing in English, French? Where are we publishing? There is no electorate. Of course, there is an electorate. People vote in European elections. Not many of them. 17-18% of the population votes in European elections. Can you name your MEP? No,
don't put me
I
on
thought
the spot
not.
As well, please.
I thought not. Neither can I. So you're talking about political entities and bureaucratic entities that have almost no identity outside, I guess, the Brussels beltway. And they know the language and they know the game, but they're not a big readership and they're not a big popular constituency. And I have to say, finally, that the road is littered with corpses. Do you remember the European, George? Mm-hmm. You probably remember the European. I mean, people have tried this before because they say, quite rightly, this is a big, you know, important thing and we should be reporting it properly. And then they try. And gosh, it's difficult. It's not the same.
And if what you're reporting is capitals and states and countries across the European chessboard, so to speak, you're up against, online, you're up against the Financial Times. Tough opposition.
Mm. Is there a problem then fundamentally in terms of how we cover, how we talk about Brussels, I guess, in the day-to-day, and the sort of reporting that, absence of that, or is it absent for a reason when we look at the sort of the European Union more broadly?
Well, the European Union system is a system which finds power extremely hard to focus, whereas in Washington, power is focused. Yeah. And that is why it produces both drama and reportable things. It's not that nothing unimportant is going on in Brussels at all, but there's plenty of important stuff going on. It's just very, very difficult to do and to get at, and lots of noble people try every day. I just don't quite see why Politico think that that's the beating heart of what they're doing. If they said, we're going to do Europe from, you know, from Ireland to Russia, and we'll do a bit of Brussels along the way, that would look like an ambitious attempt, but it would make better sense to me.
Is this a good story, though? I mean, what about a good news story just from the journalism point of view? Presumably the fact that people are willing to make this investment. There's also a print product, we understand, which will be focused as the one that looks at published in DC is published in out of Brussels. We should at least, I don't know, commend the sentiment.
Absolutely. They're creating jobs for journalists. How could we not like that? In my heart goes out to them slightly, because I do think that there's a, perhaps, I mean, I don't know what they think, but I think that there is a misconception in the notion that you can translate the success in the US to Brussels. I mean, for a start, if you see a headline about politics in Washington, you'll probably read the piece. If you see a headline about politics in Brussels, you'd either, you know, slump into your cornflakes or turn the page. People, it's a turnoff. People don't, there is nowhere that you vote for the government of Europe. Whereas, you know, every American has an interest in voting for the government of the United States. And we all have an interest in that result. Whereas, you know, the government of Europe is a messy, as George says, a messy, complicated, unclear thing.
But the
power between national governments and the Commission is also unclear. It's a bit like trying to cover the United Nations properly, another thing that's not done.
But the arrival of Politico does happen to mark a moment where new online-only news sites, a lot of them American, have now reached the point of confidence and resources to go abroad. That's a big deal. That's the next round of experiments. Some will fail, some will succeed. But them reaching across the sea, it means that the pace of experiment, the scale of experiment, it's all getting better.
Well, that's an interesting point, actually. Could this work somewhere else then, Isabel? I mean, I wonder, with your sort of China dialogue hat on, you know, could this work somewhere else within an Asian market? Obviously, there's certain limitations to trying to roll something like that.
A little tricky.
Beijing, for example.
Yep.
But I know, it's interesting. I mean, are there other markets where perhaps a more of a sort of pan-regional approach would actually lend itself to the Politico sort of model?
Possibly Asia, except for China. I mean, again, that's not one political entity, but Asia, I mean, India, it might work, actually. I mean, covering Indian politics properly would be a service to mankind. I think that, as George says, the evolution in online journalism is interesting. I mean, you've got successful business models now in online journalism, and that's very good news, because for a long time, you know, 5 years ago, we were all scratching our head watching the decline of newspapers and thinking that this was also the decline of journalism. And clearly this is no longer, you know, the case. So that's very encouraging and important. I'm just not sure they picked the right fight, but there is no reason why this shouldn't work elsewhere. You know, wouldn't it be great to have it in Russia, for instance?
Well, that's an idea and a half. George, a final thought on this then. if it doesn't pan out exactly as they'd planned, what sort of time frame do you think they're looking at? Is it going to be one of these things where the problems become apparent quite quickly, or do you think they're throwing a lot of resources, a lot of I'm sure a lot of very smart people involved? Do you think they can sort of weather the storm for a while?
Well, I'm sure they have a plan, and I would be surprised if anything failed kind of within a year. But after all, these are people who have built an online website. You are very, very sensitive to economics if you've gone through that struggle, because everybody has to form their own way of doing the revenue. Politico doesn't make an enormous amount of what it does. It sells special subscription services, do events, and have a small print product, very, very limited in geography, which brings in the advertising. So the actual online site is floated by other things. It's a very clever mixture, but it's particular to them. But they will be geared for any sign of trouble. And if it doesn't work, I wouldn't expect it to last that long. But then they may go somewhere else. Good luck getting into India. But as Isabel rightly says, that would be a terrific place if they did succeed
there. They're not, by the way, the only journalistic operation that runs on conferences and other events.
Certainly not.
The Financial Times is often described as a conference business with a rather good paper attached. So, you know, all kinds of media, including this one, have got mixed models.
And political events in particular. The Texas Tribune, really makes quite a lot of its money from events. That's the great poster boy for that particular way of doing things.
A lot of exciting models. Well, we'll watch Politico's European bid with interest. We'll take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, and my guests, George Brock and Isabel Hilton. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about press censorship and even a bit of Chinese football, just for good measure. Stay tuned.
The Monocle Daily sets the agenda in Asia and considers what's been dominating the day in Europe and North America.
The programme is often co-hosted out of our Toronto and New York bureau and features regular interviews with special guests both there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London.
Monocle 24's regular weekly guide to the perfect Friday night in includes some of our favourite cities around the world and features the insights of the people who know those places best, our unrivalled network of correspondents.
Join me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller.
Your regular hosts for the Monocle Daily every weekday at 6 a.m. in Tokyo, 2200 hours in London.
From a 71-year-old barber to a century-old cafe owner, Monocle Films visits Japan's sprightly elderly who are showing little sign of letting up.
For many in this long-living country, the official retirement age is merely a number. Up and down the country, many people in Japan are working well into their 70s and 80s, and sometimes even beyond. 100-year-old Ichiro Sekiguchi says that working has kept him fit. Today, he is still in charge at Café de l'Ombre, the coffee house he opened in Ginza in 1948.
Older, wiser, and going strong. Senior style in Japan. Premiering now in the film section on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, George Brock, author of Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age, and the journalist Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue. Let's take a look now at a couple of press freedom stories that have caught our eye here at Midori House, one in Mexico, one in China. In Mexico, one of the country's most famous journalists was fired this past weekend after she reported on a potential conflict of interest involving Mexico's First Lady. Carmen Aristegui was given the boot by MVS Radio, which claimed to let her go after she said she would quit if MVS didn't reinstate two members of her team who'd previously been dismissed. But others aren't so sure that's the real reason, and the case has kicked up something of a storm about press censorship. George, we love talking about press censorship, though often it's slightly alarming. What do you make of this story? Is this a bit of heavy-handed intervention again in the press by the sort of the political classes, or is it not something perhaps we should worry about? Is it what they're claiming?
No, I think it probably is heavy-handed interference. In the old days, governments censored people with the aid of laws and machinery of that kind that belongs with laws. Now what they do is a form of predatory manipulation via cronies, usually, or more commonly, and it looks as if this is an example of that. However, I think in this case they will have difficulty stopping this particular Mexican journalist doing it. Apart from anything else, she's got another daily radio show on a completely different network. And it is fairly clear that the story that most probably got her in trouble, which was the president's wife buying a house from a man who did business with the government, was right on the nail, because the transaction stopped after she revealed it, which leads me to infer that she'd probably hit her target.
You know, given she's got these other platforms, should we be, I don't know, as well, reassured by that? Or is it still alarming when you see this sort of intervention in, particularly, you know, as George mentions, you know, what appears to be a well-researched, well-produced piece of journalism, investigative journalism? And I think it's important to mention of the type, perhaps in Mexico, that is seen relatively seldom.
There's quite a lot of investigative journalism in Mexico, but there is also, you know, a pretty robust, it's not a robust monochrome state, but there are a lot of very powerful interests. We saw, for instance, with the murder of 40 plus students, which has been a scandal that's been running for months and months and months, that was extremely difficult to report. But it's not just Mexico. I have to say, all over Latin America, the press has come under terrible pressure in recent years. And this in democracy. So in Argentina, the opposition press is really beaten up by the government of Presidenta Cristina. And she bans, for instance, all government advertising in newspapers she doesn't like, sends the tax inspectors in to do them over, so they get tied up for, you know, weeks and weeks dealing with bureaucracy. In Venezuela, you have a similar situation with a very, you know, dogmatic and ideological government, which takes it out on the opposition press. So it's not just in Mexico, but this is a phenomenon that we're seeing increasingly across Latin America. And it's about authoritarian democratic governments, if you like, wanting to make sure that they dominate the airwaves.
Well, let me move on, Isabel, and actually ask you about the Chinese example, which I mentioned. This is this film about air pollution in China called Under the Dome. It went viral. It had a great deal of success, many millions of views, made by a newscaster for China Central Television, and subsequently then running into trouble with government censors. It was interesting that the Chinese premier was asked about this at the weekend, and then he conveniently, you know, vowed to do more to combat pollution. I mean, what does this incident tell us, I suppose, about China and its own experience with dealing with, I don't know, difficult to broach subjects?
Well, here we have undemocratic authoritarian governments and how they're dealing with it. But actually, this is a very, very interesting case because it had phenomenal success very quickly. 200 million people watched it online. It was a sort of version of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. It was the same kind of format. It wasn't revealing anything people didn't know. They lived this absolutely every day. You know, you have one child, you can't let it go out to play because the air is toxic. So you have to say, so why was it such a hit? Why was it such a success? The other interesting thing about it is that this was clearly not made against the government's, or at least parts of the government's, wishes. So then you have to look at what do we mean when we say the Chinese government? This is not, again, a monolithic institution. Mm. So you have the Ministry of Environmental Protection, which is a weak but reasonably honest ministry that has absolutely reached the limits of its power up against very powerful economic interests, against big state-owned enterprises, against other bits of government that would rather prioritize GDP growth. And so you have officials appearing in this film, talking on camera very, you know, openly. The government then lets it run for, you know, best part of 10 days, I think, in the approach to what's called the Lianghui, the two meetings. So the main one of which is the National People's Congress, big political set piece theater. So it's as though that those who were really serious about cleaning up the environment were having a run at mobilizing public opinion and putting pressure on those meetings. And I would count amongst those probably the Prime Minister, Li Keqiang. But of course, it's popularity. There is a point in this film where she urges citizens to take action. And I think the sheer scale of the popularity of this began to alarm them. And the thought that people would take to the streets, it was kind of uh-oh. But so what we see is calibration. Yes, the film's been closed down. Nothing has happened to her. Nothing will happen to her. And you have ratcheted up concern several notches, which is good for people who are trying to clean up.
The insights there of Isabel Hilton, taking us almost to the end of the programme. I'm afraid, George, we didn't get to come on to Chinese football, which I knew is what you most wanted to talk about, but I'm afraid there we must
leave. You know me.
That's what we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks to Isabel and to George, and to our producer today, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Mike Hewin, and our studio manager, Wei Dong Lin. Stay tuned. Marcus Hippie's with you next up on Monocle 24, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow.